Penetrating further and further into the heart of the Japanese cruising ground, the Pequod was soon all astir in the fishery. Often in mild, pleasant weather, for 12, 15, 18, or 20 hours on the stretch, they were engaged in the boats, steadily pulling or sailing or paddling after the whales, or for an interlude of 60 or 70 minutes calmly awaiting their uprising, though but with small success for their pains. At such times, under an abated sun, afloat all day upon the smooth, slow-heaving swells, seated in his boat, light as a birch canoe, and so sociably mixing with the soft waves themselves that like hearthstone cats they purr against the gunwale. These are the times of dreamy quietude, when beholding the tranquil beauty and brilliancy of the ocean skin, one forgets the tiger heart that pants beneath it, and would not willingly remember that this velvet paw but conceals a remorseless fang. Some days after reaching the cruising grounds, four whales were slain in one afternoon. They had died wide apart, one far to windward, one less distant to leeward, one ahead, one astern. These last three were brought alongside ere nightfall, but the windward one could not be reached till morning, and the boat that had killed it lay by its side all night. And that boat was Ahab's. The waif pole was thrust upright into the dead whale's spout hole, and the lantern hanging from its top cast a troubled, flickering glare upon the black, glossy back, and far out upon the midnight waves, which gently chafed the whale's broad flank, like soft surf upon a beach. Ahab and all his boat's crew seemed asleep, but Fedalla, the Parsi, who, crouching in the bow, sat watching the sharks that spectrally played round the whale, and tapped the light cedar planks with their tails. Started from his slumbers, Ahab face to face saw the Parsi, and hooped round by the gloom of the night, they seemed the last men in a flooded world. "I have dreamed it again," said Ahab. "Of the hearses?" said Fedalla. "Have I not said, old man, that neither hearse nor coffin can be thine?"
"And who are hearsed that die on the sea?"
"But I said, old man, that ere thou couldst die on this voyage, two hearses must verily be seen by thee on the sea, the first not made by mortal hands, and the visible wood of the last one must be grown in America."
"Aye, a strange sight that, Parsi. A hearse and its plumes floating over the ocean with the waves for the pallbearers. Ah, such a sight we shall not soon see."
"Believe it or not, thou canst not die till it be seen, old man."
"And what was that saying about thyself?"
"Though it come to the last, I shall still go before thee, thy pilot."
"And when thou art so gone before, if that ever befall, then ere I can follow, thou must still appear to me again, to pilot me still. Was it not so? Well then, did I believe all ye say, O my pilot, I have here two pledges that I shall yet slay Moby Dick and survive it."
"Take another pledge, old man," said the Parsi, as his eyes lighted up like fireflies in the gloom. "Hemp only can kill thee."
"The gallows, ye mean? I am immortal, then, on land and on sea," cried Ahab, with a laugh of derision. "Immortal on land and on sea."
Both were silent again, as one man. The gray dawn came on, and the slumbering crew arose from the boat's bottom, and ere noon the dead whale was brought to the ship.
Warmest climes but nurse the cruelest fangs. The tiger of Bengal crouches in spiced groves of ceaseless verdure. Skies the most effulgent but basket the deadliest thunders. Gorgeous Cuba knows tornadoes that never swept tame northern lands. So too is it that in these resplendent Japanese seas, the mariner encounters the direst of all storms, the typhoon. It will sometimes burst from out that cloudless sky like an exploding bomb upon a dazed and sleepy town. Towards evening of that day, the Pequod was torn of her canvas, and Bearpold was left to fight a typhoon which had struck her directly ahead. When darkness came on, sky and sea roared and split with the thunder, and blazed with the lightning that showed the disabled masts fluttering here and there with the rags which the first fury of the tempest had left for its aftersport. Holding by a shroud, Starbuck was standing on the quarterdeck, at every flash of lightning glancing aloft to see what additional disaster might have befallen the intricate hamper there, while Stubb and Flask were directing the men in the higher hoisting and firmer lashing of the boats. But all their pain seemed naught, though lifted to the very top of the cranes, the windward quarter-boat, Ahab's, did not escape. A great rolling sea, dashing high up against the reeling ship's high-teetering side, stove in the boat's bottom at the stern, and left it again, all dripping through like a sieve.
Bad work, Mr. Starbuck, said Stubb, regarding the wreck. But the sea will have its way. Stubb, for one, can't fight it. You see, Mr. Starbuck, a wave has such a great long start before it leaps. All the world it runs, and then comes the spring. But as for me, all the start I have to meet it is just across the deck here.
Here, cried Starbuck, seizing Stubb by the shoulder and pointing his hand towards the weather bow. Markest thou not that the gale comes from the eastward? The very course Ahab is to run for Moby Dick? The very course he swung to this day noon? Now, mark his boat there. Where is that stove? In the stern sheets, man, where he is wont to stand. His standpoint is stove, man.
I don't half understand ye. What's in the wind?
Yes. Yes, round the Cape of Good Hope is the shortest way to Nantucket, soliloquized Starbuck suddenly, heedless of Stubb's question. The gale that now hammers at us to stave us, we can turn it into a fair wind that will drive us towards home. Yonder to windward, all is blackness of doom, but to leeward, homeward, I see it lightens up there, but not with the lightning. At that moment, in one of the intervals of profound darkness following the flashes, a voice was heard at Starbuck's side, and almost at the same instant a volley of thunder peals rolled overhead. "Who's there?"
"Old Thunder," said Ahab, groping his way along the bulwarks to his pivot hole, but suddenly finding his path made plain to him by elbowed lances of fire.
Now, as the lightning rod to a spire on shore is intended to carry off the perilous fluid into the soil, so the kindred rod which at sea some ships carry to each mast is intended to conduct it into the water. But as this conductor must descend to considerable depth, that its end may avoid all contact with the hull, and as, moreover, if kept constantly towing there, it would be liable to many mishaps, besides interfering not a little with some of the rigging, and more or less impeding the vessel's way in the water, because of all this, the lowered parts of a ship's lightning rods are not always overboard, but are generally made in long, slender links, so as to be more readily hauled up into the chains outside, or thrown down into the sea, as occasion may require.
"The rods! The rods!" cried Starbuck to the crew, suddenly admonished to vigilance by the vivid lightning that had just been darting flambeaux to light Ahab to his post. "Are they overboard? Drop them over, fore and aft, quick!"
"Avast!" cried Ahab. "Let them be, sir."
"Look aloft," shouted Starbuck. "The corpuscents! The corpuscents!"
All the yardarms were tipped with a pallid fire, and touched at each tri-pointed lightning rod end with three tapering white flames. Each of the three tall masts was silently burning in that sulphurous air, like three gigantic wax tapers before an altar. While this pallidness was burning aloft, few words were heard from the enchanted crew, who in one thick cluster stood in the forecastle, all their eyes gleaming in that pale phosphorescence, like a faraway constellation of stars. Relieved against the ghostly light, the gigantic jet negro, Dagoo, loomed up to thrice his real stature, and seemed the black cloud from which the thunder had come. The parted mouth of Tashtego revealed his shark-white teeth, which strangely gleamed as if they too had been tipped by corpuscence. While lit up by the preternatural light, Queequeg's tattooing burned like satanic blue flames on his body. At the base of the mainmast, full beneath the doubloon and the flame, the Parsi was kneeling in Ahab's front, but with his head bowed away from him, while nearby, from the arched and overhanging rigging where they had just been engaged securing a spar, a number of the seamen, arrested by the glare, now cohered together and hung, pendulous, like a knot of numbed wasps before a drooping orchard twig. In various enchanted attitudes, like the standing or stepping or running skeletons in Herculaneum, others remained rooted to the deck, but all their eyes upcast.
"Aye, men," cried Ahab, "look up at it. Mark it well. The white flame but lights the way to the white whale. O thou clear spirit, of thy fire thou madest me, and like a true child of fire, I breathe it back to thee. Leap, leap up and lick the sky. I leap with thee. I burn with thee. Would fain be welded with thee. Defyingly, I worship thee."
"The boat, the boat," cried Starbuck. "Look at thy boat, old man." Ahab's harpoon remained firmly lashed in its crotch, so that it projected beyond his whaleboat's bow, but the sea that had stove its bottom had caused the loose leather sheath to drop off, and from the keen steel barb there now came a leveled flame of pale, forked fire. As the silent harpoon burned there like a serpent's tongue, Starbuck grasped Ahab by the arm.
"God is against thee, old man. Forbear! 'Tis an ill voyage, ill begun, ill continued. Let me square the yards while we may, and make a fair wind of it homewards to go on a better voyage than this."
Overhearing Starbuck, the panic-stricken crew instantly ran to the braces, though not a sail was left aloft. For the moment, all the aghast mate's thoughts seemed theirs. They raised a half-mutinous cry. But snatching the burning harpoon, Ahab waved it like a torch among them, swearing to transfix with it the first sailor that but cast loose a rope's end. Petrified by his aspect, and still more shrinking from the fiery dart that he held, the men fell back in dismay, and Ahab again spoke.
"All your oaths to hunt the white whale are as binding as mine, and heart, soul, and body, lungs, and life, old Ahab is bound. And that ye may know to what tune this heart beats, look ye here. Thus I blow out the last fear."
And with one blast of his breath, he extinguished the flame. And as in the hurricane that sweeps the plain, men fly the neighborhood of some lone, gigantic elm, whose very height and strength but render it so much the more unsafe, because so much the more a mark for thunderbolts, so at those last words of Ahab's, many of the mariners did run from him in a terror of dismay. Some hours after midnight, the typhoon abated so much that through the strenuous exertions of Starbuck and Stubb, one engaged forward and the other aft, the shivered remnants of the jib and fore and main topsails were cut adrift from the spars. They went eddying away to leeward like the feathers of an albatross, which sometimes are cast to the winds when that storm-tossed bird is on the wing. The three corresponding new sails were now bent and reefed, and a storm trysail was set further aft, so that the ship soon went through the water with some precision again, and the course, for the present east-southeast, which he was to steer, if practicable, was once more given to the helmsman, for during the violence of the gale he had only steered according to its vicissitudes. But as he was now bringing the ship as near her course as possible, watching the compass meanwhile, lo, a good sign, the wind seemed coming round astern. Aye, the foul breeze became fair. Instantly the yards were squared, the crew singing for joy that so promising an event should so soon have falsified the evil portents preceding it. In compliance with the standing order of his commander, to report immediately, and at any one of the 24 hours, any decided change in the affairs of the deck, Starbuck had no sooner trimmed the yards to the breeze, however reluctantly and gloomily, than he mechanically went below to apprise Captain Ahab of the circumstance. Ere knocking at his stateroom, he involuntarily paused before it a moment. The cabin lamp, taking long swings this way and that, was burning fitfully, and casting fitful shadows upon the old man's bolted door. The isolated subterraneousness of the cabin made a certain humming silence to reign there, though it was hooped round by all the roar of the elements. The loaded muskets in the rack were shiningly revealed as they stood upright against the forward bulkhead. Starbuck was an honest, upright man. But out of Starbuck's heart, at that instant when he saw the muskets, there strangely evolved an evil thought. "Strange that I," he murmured, "who have handled so many deadly lances, strange that I should shake so now. This musket here, the one with the studded stock, is it loaded, I wonder? I must see. Aye, and powder in the pan. That's not good. I come to report a fair wind to him. But how fair? Fair for death and doom. That's fair for Moby Dick. But shall this crazed old man be tamely suffered to drag a whole ship's company down to doom with him? Yes, it would make him the willful murderer of 30 men and more if this ship came to any deadly harm. And come to deadly harm, my soul swears this ship will, if Ahab have his way. If, then, he were this instant put aside, that crime would not be his. Huh? Is he muttering in his sleep? Yes, just there. In there he's sleeping. Sleeping? Aye, but still alive, and soon awake again. I can't withstand thee then, old man. Not reasoning, not remonstrance, not entreaty wilt thou hearken to. All this thou scornest. Flat obedience to thy own flat commands, this is all thou breathest. Aye, and sayest the men have vowed thy vow. Sayest all of us are Ahab's. Great God forbid! But is there no other way, no lawful way? Make him a prisoner to be taken home. What? Hope to wrest this old man's living power from his own living hands? Only a fool would try it. Say he were pinioned even, knotted all over with ropes and hawsers, chained down to the ring-bolts on this cabin floor. He would be more hideous than a caged tiger then. I could not endure the sight, could not possibly fly his howlings. All comfort, sleep itself, inestimable reason would leave me on the long, intolerable voyage. What then remains? Is heaven a murderer when its lightning strikes a would-be murderer in his bed, tindering sheets and skin together? And would I be a murderer, then, if— And slowly, stealthily, and half-sideways looking, he placed the loaded musket's end against the door. On this level, Ahab's hammock swings within, his head this way. A touch! And Starbuck may survive to hug his wife and child again. Oh, Mary, Mary! But if I wake thee not to death, old man, who can tell to what unsounded deep Starbuck's body this day week may sink with all the crew, if I but—
Stern all! Oh, Moby Dick, I clutch thy heart at last!
Such were the sounds that now came hurtling out from the old man's tormented sleep, as if Starbuck's voice had caused the long, dumb dream to speak. The yet leveled musket shook like a drunkard's arm against the panel. Starbuck seemed wrestling with an angel, but turning from the door, he placed the death tube in its rack and left the place. "He's too sound asleep, Mr. Stubb. Go through down later and wake him and tell him. I must see to the deck here. Thou knowest what to say." Steering now southeastward, the Pequod held on her path towards the equator. Making so long a passage through such unfrequented waters, descrying no ships, and ere long sideways impelled by unvarying trade winds, over waves monotonously mild. All these seemed strange, calm things, preluding some riotous and desperate scene. At last, when the ship drew near to the outskirts, as it were, of the equatorial fishing ground, and in the deep darkness that goes before the dawn was sailing by a cluster of rocky islets, the watch, then headed by Flask, was startled by a cry so plaintively wild and unearthly, like half-articulated wailings of the ghosts of all Herod's murdered innocents, that one and all they started from their reveries, and for the space of some moment stood, or sat, or leaned, transfixedly listening, like the carved Roman slave, while that wild cry remained within hearing. The Christian or civilized part of the crew said it was mermaids, and shuddered, but the pagan harpooneers remained unappalled. Yet the gray Manxman, the oldest mariner of all, declared that the wild, thrilling sounds that were heard were the voices of newly drowned men in the sea. Below, in his hammock, Ahab did not hear of this till gray dawn when he came to the deck. It was then recounted to him by Flask, not unaccompanied with hinted dark meanings. Ahab laughed hollowly and explained the wonder thus. Those rocky islands the ship had passed were the resort of great numbers of seals, and some young seals that had lost their dams, or some dams that had lost their cubs, must have risen nigh the ship and kept company with her, crying and sobbing with their human sort of wail. But this only the more affected some of them, because most mariners cherish a very superstitious feeling about seals, arising not only from their peculiar tones when in distress, but also from the human look of their round heads and semi-intelligent faces, seen peeringly uprising from the water alongside. In the sea, under certain circumstances, seals have more than once been mistaken for men. But the bodings of the crew were destined to receive a most plausible confirmation in the fate of one of their number that morning. At sunrise, this man went from his hammock to his masthead at the fore, and whether it was that he was not yet half-waked from his sleep, for sailors sometimes go aloft in a transition state, whether it was thus with the man, there is now no telling, but be that as it may, he had not been long at his perch when a cry was heard, a cry and a rushing, and looking up, they saw a falling phantom in the air, and looking down, a little tossed heap of white bubbles in the blue of the sea. The life buoy, a long, slender cask, was dropped from the stern, where it always hung obedient to a cunning spring, but no hand rose to seize it, and the sun, having long beat upon this cask, it had shrunken, so that it slowly filled, and the parched wood also filled at its every pore, and the studded iron-bound cask followed the sailor to the bottom, as if to yield him his pillow, though in sooth but a hard one. And thus the first man of the Pequod that mounted the mast to look out for the white whale, on the white whale's own peculiar ground, that man was swallowed up in the deep. But few, perhaps, thought of that at the time. Indeed, in some sort, they were not grieved at this event, at least as a portent, for they regarded it not as a foreshadowing of evil in the future, but as the fulfillment of an evil already presaged. They declared that now they knew the reason of those wild shrieks they had heard the night before. But again the old Manxman said nay. The lost life buoy was now to be replaced. Starbuck was directed to see to it. But as no cask of sufficient lightness could be found, and as in the feverish eagerness of what seemed the approaching crisis of the voyage, all hands were impatient of any toil but what was directly connected with its final end, they were going to leave the ship's stern unprovided with a buoy, when by certain strange sights and innuendos, Queequeg hinted a hint concerning his coffin. "A life buoy of a coffin?" cried Starbuck, starting.
"Rather queer, that, I should say," said Stubb.
"It will make a good enough one," said Flask. "The carpenter here can arrange it easily."
"Bring it up. There's nothing else for it," said Starbuck, after a melancholy pause. "Rig it, carpenter. Do not look at me so. The coffin, I mean. Dost thou hear me? Rig it."
"And shall I nail down the lid, sir?"
moving his hand as with a hammer. Aye. And shall I caulk the seams, sir? Moving his hand as with a caulking iron. Aye. And shall I then pay over the same with pitch, sir? Moving his hands as with a pitch pot.
Away, what possesses thee to this? Make a life buoy of the coffin, and no more. Mr. Stubb, Mr. Flask, come forward with me.
He goes off in a huff, said the carpenter to himself. Now, I don't like this. I make a coffin for Queequeg, and he won't put his head into it. Are all my pains to go for nothing with that coffin? And now I'm ordered to make a life buoy of it. It's like turning an old coat. I don't like this cobbling sort of business. I don't like it at all.
He shuffled off, still muttering.
It's undignified. It's not my place. Let tinker's brats do tinkerings. We are their betters. I like to take in hand none but clean, virgin, fair and square mathematical jobs, something that regularly begins at the beginning and is at the middle when midway and comes to an end at the conclusion. Not a cobbler's job that's at an end in the middle and at the beginning at an end. Proppered with a coffin. Sailing about with a graveyard tray. But never mind. We workers in woods work by the month or by the job or by the profit. Not for us to ask the why and wherefore of our work, unless it be to confounded cobbling, then we stash it if we can. I'll do the job now, tenderly. I'll have me, let's see, how many in the ship's company. Oh, I've forgotten. Anyway, I'll have me 30 separate Turks-headed lifelines, each 3 feet long, hanging all round the coffin. Then if the hull go down, there'll be 30 lively fellows all fighting for one coffin, a sight not seen very often beneath the sun. Come, hammer, come, caulking iron, pitch pot and marling spike. Let's go to it.
Next day, a large ship, the Rachel, was descried, bearing directly down upon the Pequod, all her spars thickly clustering with men. At the time, the Pequod was making good speed through the water, but as the broad-winged windward stranger shot nigh to her, the boastful sails all fell together as blank bladders that are burst, and all life fled from the smitten hull.
"Bad news. She brings bad news," muttered the old Manxman.
But ere her commander, who, with trumpet to mouth, stood up in his boat, ere he could hopefully hail, Ahab's voice was heard.
"Hast seen the white whale?"
"Aye, yesterday. Have ye seen a whaleboat adrift?" Throttling his joy, Ahab negatively answered this unexpected question, and would then have fain boarded the stranger, when the stranger captain himself, having stopped his vessel's way, was seen descending her side. A few keen pulls and his boat hook soon clinched the Pequod's main chains, and he sprang to the deck. Immediately he was recognized by Ahab for a Nantucketer he knew, but no formal salutation was exchanged.
"Where was he?" cried Ahab, closely advancing. "How was it? Not killed?"
It seemed that somewhat late on the afternoon of the day previous, while three of the stranger's boats were engaged with a shoal of whales, which had led them some 4 or 5 miles from the ship, and while they were yet in swift chase to windward, the white hump and head of Moby Dick had suddenly loomed up out of the blue water, not very far to leeward, whereupon the fourth rigged boat, a reserved one, had been instantly lowered in chase. After a keen sail before the wind, this fourth boat, the swiftest keeled of all, seemed to have succeeded in fastening, at least as well as the men at the masthead could tell anything about it. In the distance he saw the diminished, dotted boat, and then a swift gleam of bubbling white water, and after that, nothing more. Whence it was concluded that the stricken whale must have indefinitely run away with his pursuers, as often happens. There was some apprehension, but no positive alarm as yet. The recall signals were placed in the rigging, darkness came on, and forced to pick up her 3 far to windward boats, ere going in quest of the fourth one in the precisely opposite direction, the ship had not only been necessitated to leave that boat to its fate till near midnight, but for the time to increase her distance from it. But the rest of her crew being at last safe aboard, she crowded all sail, stunsail on stunsail, after the missing boat, kindling a fire in her tripods for a beacon, and every other man aloft on the lookout. But though when she had thus sailed a sufficient distance to gain the presumed place of the absent ones when last seen, though she then paused to lower her spare boats to pull all around her, and not finding anything, had again dashed on, again paused and lowered her boats. And though she had thus continued doing till daylight, yet not the least glimpse of the missing keel had been seen. The story told, the stranger captain immediately went on to reveal his object in boarding the Pequod. He desired that ship to unite with his own in the search, by sailing over the sea some 4 or 5 miles apart, on parallel lines, and so sweeping a double horizon, as it were.
"I will wager something now," whispered Stubb to Flask, "that someone in that missing boat wore off that captain's best coat, mayhap his watch. He's so cursed anxious to get it back."
"Whoever heard of 2 pious whale ships cruising after 1 missing whaleboat in the height of the whaling season?" said Flask. "Only see how pale he looks, pale in the very buttons of his eyes. Look, it wasn't the coat. It must have been—"
"My boy, my own boy is among them," here exclaimed the stranger captain to Ahab, who thus far had but icily received his petition. "For God's sake, I beg, I conjure, for 8 and 40 hours let me charter your ship. I will gladly pay for it, and roundly pay for it, if there be no other way. For 8 and 40 hours only that. You must, oh, you must, and you shall do this thing."
"His son," cried Stubb. "Oh, it's his boy he's lost. I take back the coat and watch. What says Ahab? We must save that boy."
"He's drowned with the rest on him last night," said the old Manx sailor standing behind them. "I heard. All of ye heard their spirits."
Now, as it shortly turned out, what made this incident of the Rachels the more melancholy was the circumstance that not only was one of the captain's sons among the number of the missing boat's crew, but among the number of the other boat's crews at the same time, but on the other hand separated from the ship during the dark vicissitudes of the chase. There had been still another son, so that for a time the wretched father was plunged to the bottom of the cruelest perplexity. This was only solved for him by his chief mate's instinctively adopting the ordinary procedure of a whale ship in such emergencies, that is, when placed between jeopardized but divided boats, always to pick up the majority first. But the captain, for some unknown constitutional reason, had refrained from mentioning all this, and not till forced to it by Ahab's iciness did he allude to his one yet missing boy. He was a little lad, but 12 years old, whose father, with the earnest but unmisgiving hardihood of a Nantucketer's paternal love, had thus early sought to initiate him in the perils of a vocation almost immemorially the destiny of all his race. Nor does it unfrequently occur that Nantucket captains will send a son of such tender age away from them for a protracted 3 or 4 years' voyage in some other ship than their own, so that their first knowledge of a whaleman's career shall be unenervated by any chance display of a father's natural but untimely partiality or undue apprehensiveness and concern. Meantime now the stranger was still beseeching his poor boon of Ahab, and Ahab still stood like an anvil, receiving every shock, but without the least quivering of his own. "I will not go," said the stranger, "till you say aye to me. Do to me as you would have me do to you in the like case, for you too have a boy, Captain Ahab, though but a child, and nestling safely at home now. A child of your old age, too. Yes, yes, you relent. I see it. Run. Run, men, now, and stand by to square in the yards."
"Avast!" cried Ahab. "Touch not a rope yarn."
Then, in a voice that prolongingly molded every word, "Captain Gardner, I will not do it. Even now I lose time. Goodbye, goodbye. God bless ye, men, and may I forgive myself, but I must go. Mr. Starbuck, look at the binnacle watch, and in 3 minutes from this present instant, warn off all strangers. Then brace forward again, and let the ship sail as before." Hurriedly turning, with averted face, he descended into his cabin, leaving the strange captain transfixed at this unconditional and utter rejection of his so earnest suit. But starting from his enchantment,
Gardiner silently hurried to the side. More fell than stepped into his boat, and returned to his ship. Soon the two ships diverged their wakes, and as long as the strange vessel was in view, she was seen to yaw hither and thither at every dark spot, however small, on the sea. This way and that, her yards were swung round. Starboard and larboard she continued to tack. Now she beat against a head sea, and again it pushed her before it, while all the while her masts and yards were thickly clustered with men, as three tall cherry trees when the boys are cherrying among the boughs. But by her still halting course and winding woeful way, you plainly saw that this ship that so wept with blinding spray still remained without comfort. She was Rachel, weeping for her children, because they were not. It was a clear steel-blue day. The firmaments of air and sea were hardly separable in that all-pervading azure. Only the pensive air was transparently pure and soft, with a woman's look, and the robust and manlike sea heaved with long, strong, lingering swells, as Samson's chest in his sleep. Hither and thither on high glided the snow-white wings of small, unspeckled birds. These were the gentle thoughts of the feminine air, but to and fro in the deeps, far down in the bottomless blue, rushed mighty leviathans, swordfish, and sharks, and these were the strong, troubled, murderous thinkings of the masculine sea. But though thus contrasting within, the contrast was only in the shades and shadows without. These two seemed one. It was only the sex, as it were, that distinguished them. Aloft, like a royal czar and king, the sun seemed giving this gentle air to this bold and rolling sea, even as bride to groom. And at the girdling line of the horizon, a soft and tremulous motion, most seen here at the equator, denoted the fond, throbbing thrust, the loving alarms with which the poor bride gave away her bosom. Tied up and twisted, gnarled and knotted with wrinkles, haggardly firm and unyielding, his eyes glowing like coals that still glow in the ashes of ruin, untottering Ahab stood forth in the clearness of the morn, lifting his splintered helmet of a brow to the fair girl's forehead of heaven. Slowly crossing the deck from the scuttle, Ahab leaned over the side and watched how his shadow in the water sank and sank to his gaze, the more and the more that he strove to pierce the profundity. But the lovely aromas of that enchanted air did at last seem to dispel, for a moment, the cankerous thing in his soul. That glad, happy air, that winsome sky, did at last stroke and caress him. The stepmother world, so long cruel, forbidding, now threw affectionate arms round his stubborn neck and did seem to joyously sob over him, as if over one that, however willful and erring, she could yet find it in her heart to save and to bless. From beneath his slouched hat, Ahab dropped a tear into the sea. Nor did all the Pacific contain such wealth as that one wee drop.
Side 6.
Starbuck saw the old man, saw him, how he heavily leaned over the side, and he seemed to hear in his own true heart the measureless sobbing that stole out of the center of the serenity around. Careful not to touch him, or be noticed by him, he yet drew near to him and stood there. Ahab turned.
Starbuck.
Sir?
Oh, Starbuck, it is a mild, mild wind and a mild-looking sky. On such a day, very much such a sweetness as this, I struck my first whale, a boy harpooner of 18. 40 years ago. 40 years of continual whaling. 40 years of privation and peril and storm time. 40 years on the pitiless sea. For 40 years has Ahab forsaken the peaceful land. For 40 years to make war on the horrors of the deep. Aye, and yes, Starbuck, out of those 40 years I have not spent 3 ashore. Away, whole oceans away, from that young girl wife I wedded past 50, and sailed for Cape Horn the next day, leaving but one dent in my marriage pillow. Wife. Wife. Rather a widow with her husband alive. I widowed that poor girl when I married her, Starbuck. And then the madness, the frenzy, the boiling blood, and the smoking brow, for which for 1,000 lowerings old Ahab has furiously, foamingly chased his prey, more a demon than a man. Aye, what a 40 years fool, fool, old fool has Ahab been. Why this strife of the chase? Why weary and palsy the arm at the oar, and the iron, and the lance? How the richer or better is Ahab now? Behold, O Starbuck, is it not hard that with this weary load I bear, one poor leg should have been snatched from under me? Here, brush this old hair aside, it blinds me that I seem to weep. Locks so gray did never grow but from out some ashes. But do I look very old, so very, very old, Starbuck? I feel deadly faint. Bowed and humped, as though I were Adam, staggering beneath the piled centuries since paradise. God, God, crack my heart, stave my brain, mockery, biting mockery of gray hairs. Have I lived enough joy to wear ye, and seem and feel thus intolerably old? Close, stand close to me, Starbuck. Let me look into a human eye. It is better than to gaze into sea or sky, better than to gaze upon God. By the green land, by the bright hearthstone, this is the magic glass, man. I see my wife and my child in thine eye. No, no, stay on board, on board. Lower not when I do, when branded Ahab gives chase to Moby Dick. That hazard shall not be thine. No, no, not with the faraway home I see in that eye. Oh, my captain, noble soul, grand old heart, after all, why should anyone give chase to that hated fish? Away with me! Let us fly these deadly waters! Let us home! Wife and child, too, are Starbucks. Away! Let us away! This instant let me alter the course. How cheerily, how hilariously, oh, my captain, would we bowl on our way to see old Nantucket again! I think, sir, they have some such mild blue days, even as this, in Nantucket. They have. I have seen them. Some summer days in the morning. About this time. Yes, it is his noon nap now. The boy vivaciously wakes, sits up in bed, and his mother tells him of me, of cannibal old me, how I am abroad upon the deep, but will yet come back to dance him again. 'Tis my Mary herself. She promised me that my boy every morning should be carried to the hill to catch the first glimpse of his father's sail. Yes, yes, no more, it is done. We head for Nantucket. Come, my captain, study out the course and let us away. See, see the boy's face from the window, the boy's hand on the hill. But Ahab's glance was averted. Like a blighted fruit tree he shook, and cast his last cindered apple to the soil. What is it? What nameless, inscrutable, unearthly thing is it? What cozening hidden lord and master and cruel, remorseless emperor commands me, that against all natural lovings and longings I so keep pushing and crowding and jamming myself on all the time, recklessly making me ready to do what in my own proper natural art I durst not so much as dare? Is Ahab, Ahab? Is it I, God, or who, that lifts this arm?
But if the great sun move not of himself, but is an errand boy in heaven, nor one single star can revolve, but by some invisible power, how then can this one small heart beat, this one small brain think thoughts, unless God does that beating, does that thinking, does that living, and not I? By heaven, man, we are turned round and round in this world, like yonder windlass, and fate is the handspike. And all the time, lo, that smiling sky, and this unsounded sea. Look, see yon albacore, who puts it into him to chase and fang that flying fish. Where do murderers go, man? Who's to doom when the judge himself is dragged to the bar? But it is a mild, mild wind, in a mild-looking sky. And the air smells now as if it blew from a faraway meadow. They have been making hay somewhere under the slopes of the Andes, Starbuck, and the mowers are sleeping among the new-mown hay. Sleeping? Aye, toil how we may, we all sleep at last on the field. Sleep? Aye, and rust amid greenness, as last year's scythes flung down and left in the half-cut swathes. Starbuck!
But blanched to a corpse's hue with despair, the mate had stolen away. Ahab crossed the deck to gaze over on the other side, but started at two reflected, fixed eyes in the water there. Fedallah was motionlessly leaning over the same rail. That night, in the mid-watch, when the old man stepped forth from the scuttle in which he leaned and went to his pivot hole, he suddenly thrust out his face fiercely, snuffing up the sea air as a sagacious ship's dog will in drawing nigh to some barbarous isle. He declared that a whale must be near. Soon that peculiar odor, sometimes to a great distance given forth by the living sperm whale, was palpable to all the watch. Nor was any mariner surprised when, after inspecting the compass and then the dog vane, and then ascertaining the precise bearing of the odor as nearly as possible, Ahab rapidly ordered the ship's course to be slightly altered and the sail to be shortened. The acute policy dictating these movements was sufficiently vindicated at daybreak by the sight of a long sleek on the sea directly and lengthwise ahead, smooth as oil, and resembling in the pleated watery wrinkles bordering it the polished, metallic-like marks of some swift tide rip at the mouth of a deep, rapid stream.
Man the mastheads! Call all hands!
Thundering with the butts of three clubbed handspikes on the forecastle deck, Daggoo roused the sleepers with such judgment claps that they seemed to exhale from the scuttle, so instantaneously did they appear with their clothes in their hands.
What do you see?
Cried Ahab, flattening his face to the sky.
Nothing, sir, nothing,
was the sound hailing down in reply.
T'gallant sails, stunsails, alow and aloft and on both sides.
All sail being set, he now cast loose the lifeline, reserved for swaying him to the main royal masthead, and in a few moments they were hoisting him thither, when, while but two-thirds of the way aloft, and while peering ahead between the main topsail and topgallant sail, he raised a cry in the air.
There she blows! There she blows! A hump like a snow hill! It is Moby Dick!
Fired by the cry, which seemed simultaneously taken up by the three lookouts, the men on deck rushed to the rigging to behold the famous whale they had so long been pursuing. Ahab had now gained his final perch, some feet above the other lookouts. From this height, the whale was now seen some mile or so ahead, at every roll of the sea, revealing his high, sparkling hump, and regularly jetting his silent spout into the air.
"And did none of ye see it before?"
cried Ahab, hailing the perched men all around him.
"I saw him almost that same instant, sir, and I cried out," said Tashtego.
"Not the same instant, not the same. No, the doubloon is mine. Fate reserved the doubloon for me, I only. None of ye could have raised the white whale first. There she blows! There she blows!"
cried Ahab in long-drawn, lingering, methodic tones, attuned to the gradual prolongings of the whale's visible jets.
"He's going to sound. In stunsails, down topgallantsails, stand by three boats.
Mr. Starbuck, stay on board and keep the ship. Helm there. Luff. Luff a point. Steady, man. Steady. There go flukes. All ready, the boat's there. Stand by. Stand by. Lower me, Mr. Starbuck, quick.
And he slid through the air to the deck.
He is heading straight to leeward, sir, cried Stubb. Right away from us. Cannot have seen the ship yet.
Stand by the braces. Hard down the helm. Boats. Boats. Brace her up.
Soon all the boats but Starbuck's were dropped. All the boat sails set. All the paddles plying with rippling swiftness, shooting to leeward, and Ahab heading the onset. A pale death glimmer lit up Fedallah's sunken eyes. A hideous motion gnawed his mouth. Like noiseless nautilus shells, their light prows sped through the sea. But only slowly they neared the foe. As they neared him, the ocean grew still more smooth, seemed drawing a carpet over its waves, so serenely it spread. At length, the breathless hunter came so nigh his seemingly unsuspecting prey that his entire dazzling hump was distinctly visible, sliding along the sea as if an isolated thing, and continually set in a revolving ring of finest, fleecy greenish foam. He saw the vast, involved wrinkles of the slightly projecting head beyond. Before it, far out on the soft, Turkish-rugged waters, went the glistening white shadow from his broad, milky forehead, a musical rippling playfully accompanying the shade. And behind, the blue waters interchangeably flowed over into the moving valley of his steady wake, and on either hand bright bubbles arose and danced by his side. Like to some flagstaff rising from the painted hull of an argosy, the tall but shattered pole of a recent lance projected from the white whale's back. At intervals, one of the cloud of soft-toed fowls hovering